Chapter 7. Canaries. The end of curfew siren woke Lucy with a jolt. Unlike the three blasts used to begin the curfew at night, the morning signal was just one blast of around 8 seconds. It was an appalling way to wake up. Dan, however, didn't stir, the lucky bastard. Lucy instinctively went to rub her eyes, banging her glove-covered hands straight into her visor. She groaned, flopping back down onto the mattress where she lay, listening to the crinkling of her suit. An amplified army announcement from the street interrupted her wallowing. She turned towards the source of the sound, her hazmat suit creaking and crumpling as it twisted beneath her. The truck slowly rumbled by, repeating the same message that KGO 810 had broadcast 2 nights previously. All able-bodied citizens, report to City Hall for immediate reassignment. Rations will no longer be delivered. You must collect them in person. Report to City Hall. Her eyes fell upon a picture on her bedside table, a framed portrait she'd sketched of the two of them, illuminated as it was by the morning light. She turned again and looked at her sleeping partner now, noting their matching plastic pajamas. Perhaps she should do them a fresh portrait. She gave Dan a nudge, then a slightly less tender one, which actually woke him up. We need to go. Madonna was still alive when they woke, so once again they took the calculated risk to remove their hazmat suits. Seizing the precious window of safety, they hastily ate, cleaned themselves using wet wipes, and defecated before putting the suits straight back on. The suits were off and on again within 12 minutes. Dan timed them using the wall clock. The volume of food they had to gobble down left them both feeling physically ill afterwards, but it was necessary given that they didn't know when or where it would next be safe to eat. Once again, they called on Manuela's apartment for help. They needed to be out of the suits to be able to take a shit, which meant the hamster-certified air of their apartment was the only safe place to risk doing it. But they'd sealed up all the utilities, and an ever-mounting pile of sewage in the apartment's stagnant toilet didn't seem like a desirable plan. The inglorious resolution they settled on involved Dan's bucket, a makeshift lid, and a shameful, hurried journey downstairs wearing the hazmat suits to Manuela's apartment, where they emptied the bucket into her disused toilet. We need to remember to flush that toilet when the power comes on next, noted Dan, returning the bucket to their apartment before the pair of them set off. With calories at a premium now, they decided they should get the bus to City Hall. But 30 minutes elapsed and no bus came. Lucy had never felt so grateful for bus shelter seats. The number of people waiting grew from 3 to 20. Each new arrival eyed her and Dan with deep suspicion, glaring at the fully suited couple from beneath their simple face masks and giving them a wide berth. Where'd you get those suits? Challenged a new arrival, staggering over to them. He was in his 40s, unshaven, and drinking openly from a bottle of scotch. Lucy looked away, blushing. Hey, I'm talking to you, he said, getting closer still. She felt the eyes of all 20 other commuters staring at her. Sir, you should be wearing a mask, replied Dan. Masks are for pussies, laughed the man, taking a swig from his bottle. And those fucking things, he continued, gesturing to their hazmat suits with derision, are for faggots. Lucy looked at Dan nervously as the drunkard opened his arms wide, inviting retaliation. Dan simply stared at him, blinking freely, not giving anything away. Yeah? What are you gonna do about it? Said the man, swaying. What are you gonna do, Mr. Suit Man? Dan continued to look at the man calmly. Fucking whatever, spluttered the drunkard, dropping his hands back to his sides in disappointment. Fucking suit people, he mumbled, swearing at them and everyone else at the bus stop for good measure, before staggering away, muttering to himself. Lucy exhaled heavily and looked to Dan, whose expression had hardened. You okay? She asked. Fine, replied Dan, clenching and unclenching his fists. He was just a bum, not worth engaging. Wouldn't have done us much good if I'd laid him out on the sidewalk. He's probably going to be dead soon enough anyway, wandering around like that without a mask.
Unless he's naturally resistant, noted Lucy. In which case, God help us if we've got to rebuild mankind off of his shoulders.
A police patrol slowed as it drew parallel with the bus stop.
This route is out of use, people, said the officer, speaking through the bullhorn. There's still a bus route working over on Masonic Avenue. It'll get you to City Hall, she said, surveying the crowd. Lucy shuffled her feet beneath the seat. It felt like the cop was staring at her and Dan. Did she know that they were behind the office break-in yesterday? How could they possibly explain the stolen hazmat suits? What was their cover story? The officer pulled away without further comment, and the tension gripping Lucy's chest eased. She and Dan joined the trail of people now steadily making their way to Masonic Avenue. The number of seeds drifting in the air had reduced again. Occasional yellow specks danced in the breeze, but it was a far cry from the blizzard they'd experienced before. The number of bodies, however, continued to grow. Dozens more victims lined the sidewalk, their corpses pressing into the translucent layer of gloop that was replacing the fluffy mustard-yellow spores. The bus seekers quickly defaulted to walking on the road to avoid passing the bodies littering the sidewalk. Lucy held back deliberately so that she and Dan could walk behind the crowd. She hadn't anticipated how alienating their protective layer would be. The wet spores made a loud padding sound underfoot, like walking through a shallow puddle. While the streets avoided the problem of human bodies, they were dotted with the carcasses of small animals, mainly cats and rodents, which were seemingly being marinated in the slush. The people ahead slowed to a stop as they reached a corner, which they began to bunch around. The sound of barking carried over, prompting Lucy and Dan to move to the edge of the group, where they could peer around the corner to see what was happening. A dog stood in the middle of the street ahead, barking incessantly and scampering from one side to the other. Occasionally, it stopped and pawed furiously at its head, then barked at the ground before jumping away and circling back on itself, or weaving across to another patch. "It looks rabid," said Lucy. "We need to keep the hell away from it." "I think these guys might be able to help," said Dan, spotting a military patrol advancing down the street. The dog turned towards the engine noise and increased its incessant barking, interspersing it with deep growls. The patrol slowed until it was a few yards from the feral animal, then turned side on. The passenger soldier drew his handgun, took aim at the growling dog, and fired two shots directly into its body. The dog crumpled with a yelp and lay twitching on the ground. The patrol drove on immediately. Nervously, the group edged forwards, the other civilians talking among themselves as they pressed on, giving the dead animal a wide berth.
"Luce, what are you doing?"
asked Dan, as she broke away from the group and knelt down close to the motionless dog. There were clumps of fur missing from its grimy, matted coat.
"I don't recognize this breed," she said, standing up and circling it slowly. "There's something different about it."
"Yeah, it was foaming at the mouth and ready to rip our legs off," said Dan impatiently. "We need to get a move on, Luce. I don't want to miss the only bus to City Hall and end up walking all the way there."
He began setting off after the other walkers.
"It won't be the only bus," she said, catching up.
Splat.
"Fuck," cried Dan, jumping to the side in disgust.
"Wow," said Lucy, looking up to see if more were coming. Blue skies, nothing overhead but the occasional cloud and some lilting seeds.
"That's certainly a first," she said, turning her attention back downward to the smashed-up bird by Dan's feet.
Its glistening white feathers were ruffled, sticking out at odd edges in line with the splayed posture. Its black eye stared straight up at the sky. Lucy crouched down and looked closely at the unfortunate creature. Large droplets of moisture clung to its entire body.
"Loose the bus," said Dan, pointing to the crowd of people who had begun to jog towards something around the next corner.
Abandoning the bird, the pair of them ran after the group. They caught up just in time as the last person was boarding. It was standing room only for the entire 20-minute journey. Lucy's ears pricked at the slightest throat clearing, turning each instance into the thundering death coughs of her deceased neighbor. She stared at the other passengers through her hazmat suit. They looked so vulnerable in their jeans and hoodies. Were those face masks really going to keep them all alive? She felt like an observer in a laboratory, watching the busload of test subjects from behind a safety screen. A nearby passenger sneezed twice, making Lucy shudder. Such a high concentration of people flew in the face of basic disease control.
But with no cars running, it was the only way to get people to City Hall, and they needed workers to get the power back online. Without power, there was no hope of modern medicine or sanitation being restored, and those things were key to the survival of the population in the face of this new disease. Or at least, that's what Lucy assumed was behind City Hall's logic. The bus pulled into the City Hall complex, where tens of thousands of people stood outside in long, snaking, numbered lines. Each line filtered through to a different part of the building's complex, and out of sight, so Lucy had no way of telling how long each one really was. But if the people outside were anything to go by, there could easily be 100,000 civilians gathered in total, if not more. There was a heavy military presence. Troops patrolled the lines, swiftly quelling any dissenters and dumping troublemakers to the back of the lines. Other soldiers patrolled the top of the City Hall building, scrutinizing the crowds. Before anyone could exit the bus, a sergeant stepped aboard, holding a megaphone up to his mask.
"Listen up. There are 5 lines outside. You will go and stand in the line that best fits your skill set. At the end of that line, you will be assigned your new place of work. At the end of your shift, you will be entitled to collect your rations."
"Wait, so they're only giving out regular rations in exchange for work now?" said Lucy. But before Dan could reply, the sergeant continued.
"Now there are a lot of people here, so be prepared to queue for some time. Now I will only say this once, so pay attention. Line 1 is for military. Line 2 is for medics. Line 3 is for engineers. Line 4 is agriculture. And line 5 is anyone else."
With that, he disappeared off the bus and into the crowd. The passengers spilled out onto the forecourt and began trickling into different lines.
"Where should we go?" asked Lucy as people jostled them off the bus.
"You're obviously in the military line."
"And you're obviously agriculture," said Dan.
"Right," said Lucy, "but I don't want us to be separated again."
"Me neither,"
agreed Dan, casting his eyes around.
"We'll have to lie. Just say we've got no relevant skills. We'll go line 5. I'm not leaving you this time."
She took his gloved hand in hers, and they made their way over to the back of the colossal line as dozens more people joined with them. 5 was predictably the most heavily subscribed line, with the longest wait time. Tens of thousands of people stood before them, soldiers patrolling as scores of new arrivals flooded in by the busload. A few people who appeared to show symptoms were swiftly removed from the line and taken out of sight. It was almost 4 hours before Dan and Lucy's turn came. Only once they'd finally made it inside the City Hall building could Lucy see how the line ended. A large function room contained 20 desks where individuals were processed. At each desk sat a military officer and a clerk, both of whom, to Dan and Lucy's surprise, wore hazmat suits.
"Stall E!"
barked the flustered soldier overseeing Line 5's flow, pointing Lucy and Dan to a vacant stall. The officer behind the desk of Stall E was a diminutive, bespectacled man with a crown of gray hair resting on his scalp and an expression of extreme stress on his face, all just about visible from behind his plastic visor. His expression appeared to ease a little when Lucy and Dan arrived, seemingly recognizing kindred hazmat spirits, or at least people less likely to infect him than the others waiting. Not that it made his tone any less severe.
"You afraid of heights?" he inquired, looking at Dan first.
"Not especially," replied Dan.
"Good. You're assigned to pylons. Take this form and see that guy over there," he said, gesturing minimally to a secondary booth ahead.
We're sticking together," said Dan, gesturing to Lucy.
"Then why the hell didn't you say so in the first place? God damn it,"
whined the officer, snatching the form back from Dan's hand.
"Both of you head over there,"
he said, scribbling something on 2 forms and pointing to a stall labeled assignment.
"Next,"
he bellowed as his guard assistant shoved the 2 of them along. The guard's gun and hazmat combination made him look like a low-budget film extra. They got to the next stall and handed the papers over. This officer only had a mask on, but seemed much better disposed than his colleague.
"Looks like you guys have hit the big time," he said deadpan. "Garbage duty. Grab your ration bags now and report to the east section. Find a truck and hop aboard. Got it?"
They headed sideways to the ration line where they were issued with their rations. One of the perks of garbage duty, it turned out, was that they got their rations up front, but only because they wouldn't be finishing their daily shifts at the City Hall like the other workers. After once again refusing to be separated, Lucy and Dan both got assigned to the same truck where they were dispatched on their first shift immediately, at 1 p.m., according to the onboard clock. As they rode up front in the garbage truck, the scale of the devastation became clear. Street after street was awash with bodies. Only then did it dawn on Lucy. It was their job to collect them. By the end of the day, they had become almost completely anesthetized to the expression of pain and anguish on the bodies they swung into the back of the truck. Early on, they'd been forced to abandon attempts to handle the bodies with care. The scale and difficulty of the task demanded pragmatism alone. Neither she nor Dan spoke much all day, numbed by the grim repetition. Their driver didn't utter a word during the entire shift either, making no attempt to invest in his new colleagues. Within a single afternoon, they had collected hundreds of bodies, but covered less than 2 square miles of the city. Adults, children, animals, everything went in the truck to be incinerated the same evening. Lucy, confronted by the faces of young children, sometimes still in the arms of their dead parents, nearly threw up on several occasions. The closed, unblemished storefronts of Starbucks and Urban Outfitters looked like museum pieces frozen in time, framed in the eerie, cold light of the dust cloud. Silently, achingly, Lucy and Dan systematically removed all trace of the dystopian scene that had unfolded around them. But nothing could have prepared Lucy for when they found Cassie. Her body was like all the others, paralyzed in a state of writhing agony, her face distorted by the pain that dominated every muscle upon it, her eyes pallid and sorrowful, the burst capillaries now faded. She must have died a day or two ago. What hurt the most was that no one had covered her body. Had she died alone? Or had the people she'd been with died too? Maybe they'd already put their bodies in the truck. Lucy didn't cry. She just stood in shock and stared at her best friend's lifeless body where it lay, abandoned in the street, terminated by whatever it was that was decimating mankind. She had deserved more than this. "Come on," said Dan, gently moving to stand over Cassie's shoulders, the heavier part of the body. "We'll do it together," he said, somehow managing to sound compassionate in the face of what they were about to do. They'd quickly learned with all the other bodies, apart from the smaller pets and the babies, which could be done with a single arm, that it required 2 people, one on each end, to swing the body backwards, then release, to propel it forward over the lip of the truck and into the growing pile inside. Occasionally, this was followed by the sickening crunching of bones as the machine necessarily compacted its load to make space for the next batch. But Cassie landed quietly and out of sight. They were given a light chlorine rinse in their suits back at the depot before being dismissed for the day. It turned out City Hall didn't want its new undertakers to die on the job. When they got home, Madonna greeted them with small squeaks for food, shielded from the horrors that lay outside her caged sanctuary. Neither knew what to say, both completely hollowed out by the ordeal. Dan switched on his phone and set a timer for 3 hours, during which they both collapsed onto the bed and slept in their suits. The alarm woke Lucy, and she woke Dan. Knowing the air was safe, they silently undressed and washed themselves down with wipes before putting on regular clothes. To Lucy, it felt like cheating. Make-believe. The fact of the day stood as a wall between the two of them. They remained physically exhausted, and neither had the stomach for food, but they force-fed themselves. Lucy knew their ongoing survival depended on them replenishing calories when they were available. The new ration bag sat open on the kitchen table, and she stared at it, bitterly resenting how it had come to be in their possession. "We're keeping other people alive," said Dan, breaking the silence. "By doing this, I mean." He nodded to himself several times as if repeating the sentiment internally like a mantra. But his eyes fell downward, and his head soon came to a stop. Lucy stretched out her arms, clenching her jaw and gripping either side of the table as if it were spinning out of control. Dan got up, moving over and carefully taking her in his arms. "I'm so sorry about Cassie," he said quietly. Lucy nodded, staring at the table, her eyes unfocused. His skin warmed hers. It was the first time they'd had proper contact in days. He anchored her, arms wrapped around her chest, face nestled into her shoulder, his breathing making a small patch of the back of her shirt warm and damp. All of these senses she registered as comforting, and yet she felt nothing. Cassie was gone. A knock at the door broke the long embrace. They jumped, startled, exchanging worried looks as they returned to the real world. Dan reached for a baseball bat and slowly made his way to the door, while Lucy kept her distance in case he needed to take a swing with it.
"Wait!" cried Lucy as Dan reached for the lock. "Here!"
She handed him his face mask and pulled her own over her mouth. He peered through the marble, then turned to her and nodded before opening first the chain lock and then the main lock, swinging the front door open to reveal a soldier.
"Daniel Jeffries?"
inquired the private through his protective mask.
"Yes,"
replied Dan nervously.
"This is for you,"
announced the soldier, producing an envelope and handing it to Dan before turning on his heels and retreating down the stairs. Dan closed the door and relocked it. He turned the item in his hands as he rejoined Lucy at the table.
"What is it?"
asked Lucy, noting the concern on his face.
"I don't know. Must be something to do with Dad,"
he said, tapping the government emblem. He tore the envelope open and laid the letter out on the table. "Urgent and confidential," read the subject line. Below that, a subtitle read, "Reference, Adrian Jeffries, White House Chief of Staff." The letter had taken several days to reach them, going by the date printed across it, and the body copy had clearly been sent out to multiple people. It wasn't a personalized message. Dan began to read, a small gap opening between his pursed lips as he continued, immediately lifting the letter back up off the table and bringing it closer to his eyes as they tracked rapidly from side to side. Lucy came around to his side so she could better read over his shoulder. "Dear Daniel, you and your partner have been identified as persons of national importance and vital to the reconstruction of America in the wake of the ongoing natural disaster. You and your partner have been designated a place on the evacuation train that will be departing from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. in the next 7 days. We have evidence to suggest that the airborne pathogen will begin to die out in a matter of days. Once that has been confirmed, the evacuation signal will sound across your city's curfew siren. It will sound 5 consecutive times instead of 3. This will happen once only. Only designated evacuees such as yourselves will know what it means. When you hear this, you must immediately proceed to your mustering point, which is Ashurst High School. Bring no more than 1 suitcase or equivalent each, and rations for the 4-day journey. You must be ready to evacuate at any time from this moment onwards. Once in D.C., you will be transferred to the White House, where you will help coordinate our national response to the crisis. Should you fail to arrive for departure within 3 hours of the signal, you will be assumed dead, and the train will depart without you. You must bring ID and this letter to your mustering point. Do not tell anyone where you are going. Uninvited persons attending mustering stations may be shot. Sincerely, Allison Walcock, Acting Secretary of State." Beneath the typed message was a short handwritten note.
"My son, I hope you're alive. I'll wait for you both in D.C. Be on the train. Worse is coming. Your sister is dead. So sorry to tell you like this. I love you. Dad."
Dan dropped the note and slumped against the wall, the letter falling from his hands onto the floor.
"Oh my God, Dan,"
said Lucy, rushing to her broken partner, drawing him up in her arms and pressing his head into her body as tightly as she could. Dan said nothing and just sat, his arms hanging by his sides, the words knocked from his body. She held him for a long time, then slowly led him to bed, where she eased him into his face mask and goggles, and lay him down to sleep. Comatose from grief and shock, he didn't utter a word the whole time, but allowed himself to be moved. Lucy held him and stroked his hair until he fell asleep, or at least closed his eyes to be alone. Drying her own eyes, she quietly began to pack their bags for the evacuation. Lucy awoke with a start as the regular end-of-curfew siren sounded. She sat bolt upright and listened for more pulses, but none came. 5 iterations were what they were waiting for. They'd only have minutes to react and get moving, but as the silence stretched out, her heart rate normalized again. It was a useful realization, though. What would they do if the signal came while they were at work? The only option, if they were truly to be ready at any time, was to keep their luggage with them wherever they went now. The image of Cassie's twisted body flashed vividly across Lucy's mind. She shut her eyes and shook her head in denial, reopening them to find her vision blurred behind a sheen of tears. She walked over to the hamster cage. Carefully, she opened the ceiling gate and lifted the quivering Madonna out. The creature's racing heartbeat vibrated through her hand. She stroked its soft fur, marveling at the simplicity of Madonna's world, while tears streamed down her face. She could crush that innocent, beautiful thing in an instant, she thought. Dan stirred from within the bedroom. Lucy lowered Madonna back into her cage, refastened the ceiling gate, and drained the tears from her goggles before he emerged. Dan said few words over breakfast, visibly still reeling from the loss of his sister. He nearly left the house without putting his hazmat suit on, such was his preoccupation. As they descended the stairs, clad in semi-breathable plastic and weighed down by huge hiking backpacks, Dan stopped at the 4th floor. "Does this look right to you?" he asked quietly as Lucy pulled level. The door to apartment 403 stood wide open, and a flickering light reflected off the walls. "Who even lives here?" replied Lucy, peering around. "We should check it out," said Dan, as Lucy knew he would. "That flickering looks like a candle. I don't want our whole building going up in flames if it's unattended." He knocked and called out, but no one answered. Cautiously, they entered the darkened homestead. It was different in layout to theirs, smaller, with an open-plan kitchen-living area that defined the space. The blinds were drawn, blocking the outside world. The flickering light drew Lucy's eye to an interior door on the left, which also stood ajar. She beckoned to Dan, and the two of them moved closer. "Hello?" she called out, hoping for a reply. Dan reached out and grabbed Lucy's arm, stopping her in her tracks. He stepped forward so that she was behind him, shielded. Leading the way, he delicately nudged the door open. It swung back without resistance. They edged forwards, into the threshold. On the far side of the room stood a single candle nestled within a large glass vase. It was almost burned out entirely. The candle gave a soft warmth to the well-furnished room, its irregular light quietly lapping at the two motionless bodies on the bed. The elderly couple lay entwined in each other's arms. Adjacent to them on the bedside table stood an empty bottle of sleeping pills. The pair might have looked peaceful were it not for their torn flesh. Lucy recognized the incisions. She was no stranger to the work of rats. Dan took off his backpack and leaned it against the wall. Throwing open the bedroom window, he peered down into the street below. "Let's get this done," he said, signaling to Lucy to grab the dead man's legs. "What? They're going in a garbage truck later anyway." "Who lit the candle?" asked Lucy, stalling. "It can't have burned all this time. They must have died days ago. You think someone's already found them?"
"Yeah, probably. And because they lit a candle instead of getting rid of the bodies, we've got to do it, before the whole building becomes a magnet for other problems. Now come on."
He stuck a hand under each of the old man's armpits, raising the torso off the mattress. Lucy winced as a loose flap of skin fell forward and dangled from the elderly face, revealing the muscle, bone, and tendons beneath. The hazmat suit sanitized the air, but couldn't stop her brain from replicating the scent of rotting flesh. The sickening smell cloyed at her palate. She took hold of the old man's legs, the wrinkles and elasticity of his skin detectable even through her thick suit gloves. Together they heaved his body to the window, balancing him on the sill before tipping him off. He fell quickly and landed on the street below with a thud, spraying the pavement with congealed blood. His wife followed.
"Fine," said Dan dispassionately, as they exited the old couple's flat and closed the door behind them. "Time for work."
When they returned home that evening, Madonna was dead. The caged hamster lay on its back, limbs contorted, its neck outstretched to the right as if trying to escape the rest of its diseased body. They stood in the hallway of their apartment, backpacks pressing the plastic hazmat suits into their sweaty backs, staring at the dead rodent. The disease had reached their home. Stepping back out into the stairwell, Lucy closed the apartment door. She and Dan considered their next move. Staying in their infected apartment in their hazmat suits posed an unnecessary risk. On the balance of probabilities, it made more sense to try somewhere else, which may, on the off chance, be sanitary. After some deliberation, they identified only two practical options. 403, the old couple's apartment where the occupants had died from sleeping pills, or Manuela's place, where they'd found Madonna alive and well. The reality was that both environments had since been compromised by the airflow, but Lucy and Dan were in agreement. Moving presented the least threat. They decided in favor of Manuela's apartment and put phase one into action. Lucy retrieved the key from their sideboard while Dan disposed of the hamster. He tore off the useless plastic seal they'd constructed around the kitchen window and slung Madonna's body out into the toxic night air, cursing as he slammed the window shut again. Next to him, Lucy tugged the plastic off the balcony doors and looked out into the twilight. The seeds had disappeared from the wind, and their slushy remains had largely drained away from the sidewalks and roads, but still the disease lingered. They retreated downstairs to Manuela's empty apartment. As Lucy clicked the lock open, she ducked as a startled pigeon flew wildly around the room, flapping frantically until it flew straight into the window and stunned itself. "Grab the hamster cage!" yelled Lucy as she pounced on the bird, tenderly picking it up, securing it between her gloves. Dan disappeared from the room, returning a minute later with the empty cage. He lifted the metal mesh up, and Lucy placed the dozy bird inside. Dan quickly locked the frame again before it could escape. "Looks like we found our new canary," said Lucy, watching as the drowsy bird began dragging itself into an upright position. "Technically, it's a pigeon," replied Dan, grinning. "No wonder you dropped out of veterinary college." Lucy gave him a spectacularly sarcastic smile through her mask. The power hadn't come on in several days, and from their day job, she and Dan knew why. The workforce was dying out quicker than it could be replaced. "System knowledge is dying with them," Dan surmised that night in bed. "We're going to have to start thinking longer term." The death of Elvis the pigeon further complicated matters. Elvis succumbed after just two nights, his crumpled form signaling the danger within Manuela's apartment. His demise renewed their conviction that sleeping in the hazmat suits was critical, while forcing them to move to apartment 403. "This is keeping us alive," Lucy reassured herself the morning after Elvis's passing, as she carried a bucket of her own excrement down the stairwell and outside the building. Now that their former dumping ground, Manuela's apartment, was contaminated, an alternative arrangement had become necessary. Lucy reached the bushes by the bike lockup area and dug a small hole. She tipped the waste in, then covered it over, unperturbed by the incredulous expression of a passerby across the street, instead relieved to see another survivor around. The sapling she'd seen when they'd first stolen the suits had disappeared without a trace, along with the translucent mustard gloop. She replaced the bucket in 403 and agreed to wait for Dan while he quickly hunted for batteries upstairs in their actual apartment. He returned breathless and pale. "We've been robbed," he panted from the threshold. Lucy hastened after him back up the stairs. The door of their home was wide open, the wooden frame splintered and smashed where the lock had been forced open. "They took the food," said Dan, leading the way inside. Lucy followed, registering the faint footprints on their polished wooden floor. One set was much smaller than the other. "Check this," said Dan, passing her a note. "I mean, what the actual fuck, right?" "Sorry," read the message in large block capitals written with a red Sharpie on lined notepaper. "They left this?" said Lucy, reading the one-word message. "On the kitchen table," nodded Dan. "The audacity, robbing someone and then leaving an apology note? Maybe they're just straight up mocking us." "At least they didn't get the antibiotics," said Lucy, glancing towards the bathroom. "I packed them in our evac bags."
Bastards, he cried, thumping the wall. We obviously can't ever stay here again, not with the door like that, and not when we're on someone's goddamn map.
Lucy did a sweep through the apartment. The kitchen was a mess of open drawers and cupboard doors, but the bedroom and living room were exactly as they'd left them. Did they take anything else? She asked, rejoining Dan in the corridor.
I don't think so. I think they just grabbed the food and left.
Thank God we weren't sleeping here when they broke in.
They might have robbed us in daytime. We can't be sure,
he grumbled, kicking his boots against the baseboard. Think positive. Thanks to you, we've still got half our rations, said Lucy, rubbing his back. We'll work through what we've got in 403, and when we're done, we'll get the rest from Manuela's. And then, he challenged. Don't be like that, replied Lucy.
Like what?
We got robbed, Dan, not shot. Get over your pride and stop taking this as some kind of personal failure. We don't have the energy for that.
Dan said nothing and stepped outside, leaving Lucy room to exit too before he pulled the broken door shut behind her, wedging it against the splintered frame.
What's that? She said, eyeing the crowbar in his hand.
Protection,
he replied.
You're bringing it to work?
What? No, I'm leaving it downstairs, in case anyone does try to rob us in the night.
As they retrieved their backpacks from 403, a noise, something between a long moan and a whine, pricked Lucy's ears.
You hear that? She asked Dan, pausing his rustling. I think it's coming from the elevator. It sounds like something's trapped in there.
Dan joined her by the doorway and listened.
Sounds like a cat.
Yeah, which means the owner's probably trapped in there too. We need to check it out.
Dan groaned, dropping his backpack again and fetching the crowbar.
This is exactly why I'm not a cat person.
They followed the whales downstairs to the third floor.
Here, said Lucy, draining her headlamp up on the elevator doors.
I wish I'd never bought this stupid thing,
complained Dan, wedging the crowbar between the elevator doors and leaning into it heavily.
Watch out, cried Lucy.
As Dan prized the elevator doors apart, water spilled out through the inch-wide gap, splashing out onto the hallway and down into the elevator shaft below.
What the hell?
Gasped Dan, stumbling backward and shaking the water off his suit. The gushing stream quickly subsided to dripping. Lucy peered through the slit, her light illuminating the dark void beneath the elevator base, which was suspended around 5 feet above the floor, stuck between levels.
Give me a hand,
said Dan, dropping the crowbar and placing his fingers along one of the door edges. Lucy copied, lining up against the opposite one.
Careful you don't fall inward. All right, heave!
As they each pulled a door back, a mangy cat darted from the elevator with a cry, landing on the floor and immediately springing down the dark stairwell out of sight.
There's your cat, said Dan.
I think we found the owner, too, said Lucy, looking upwards.
As they both stepped backwards, their beams illuminated the pile of rotting flesh and crumpled clothes on the dripping elevator floor.
Flies. Gross,
said Dan, switching off his headlamp.
What? I don't want them flying at me. You should turn yours off, too.
Lucy frowned, but covered her light, dimming it substantially. She could only see glimpses of the shiny, golden-shelled flies, which quickly dispersed.
Come on, said Dan. Let's get the bags and go. We've got work to do. And rations to earn.
Hey, what's up? You guys must be my new colleagues,
cheered an unfamiliar garbage truck driver as he pulled up that morning, throwing the passenger door open. An upshot of working garbage duty was that they didn't have to ride the buses to City Hall anymore. They could walk a few blocks to the truck's route and get collected.
They said you'd look weird. You guys look super weird,
yelled the driver from behind his face mask.
Get up on here now, don't be shy.
He beckoned them up and slid back over to the steering seat.
The other guy died, by the way. Sorry about that. Thought you should know. I'm Marco. Who are you?
And that was the beginning of the questions. Marco never really seemed to engage with any of the answers, and Dan never really engaged with Marco, preferring to let Lucy shoulder the brunt of the conversation.
Not that she had to do much talking.
Marco was like Da Vinci's machine of perpetual small talk, happily filling all silence with never-ending observations and banalities, interspersed with very out-of-tune rock karaoke as he incessantly looped AC/DC live albums.
Reticent as Dan was, the driver's humor lifted both of their spirits a little during the long, arduous shifts. Unlike his predecessor, Marco didn't view their hazmat suits as a reason not to talk to them both. Rather, he found them a regular source of amusement and good fodder for his irrepressible chatter.
"You guys are so funny looking," he would say every day,
several times before laughing happily. He'd then invariably be distracted by another ransacked burger joint that he used to love, or, often, the outfits of the dead people they were about to collect.
"Check out that guy's shoes! Who even wears those, man?"
Marco's profoundly cheerful detachment from, or denial of, reality served them all well, but Lucy found herself studying him while listening. All of his conversation was in the present tense, and consisted of lighthearted tip-offs about where to get the best salami in town, or his buddy's tapas bar on 8th. He spoke as if none of it had changed, and never once referred to the fact that they were stopping to collect human bodies instead of trash. Lucy suspected he wasn't entirely sober. Fortunately, the streets were devoid of other traffic or pedestrians, meaning it was just she and Dan who had to hope for the best as passengers. The chatty Reaper was also a well-connected man in the New World, it turned out, and was able to procure 2 living gerbils for Dan and Lucy in exchange for some of their rations. Meanwhile, the number of bodies was increasing faster than they could remove them. It meant they were stoking the incinerator with plenty of fuel each day, but presumably the power it generated was being routed directly to hospitals and prisons, or at least that's what Lucy assumed. She didn't know because they hadn't been able to tune in to KGO 810 for over a week, and her military sources had been replaced by the chatty AC/DC gerbil man. Maybe they weren't generating power at all, she considered, as the days passed. Maybe they were just burning bodies.
Ew,
cried Lucy, leaping back and dropping her end of a corpse one afternoon.
What the hell, Luce?
Said Dan, still holding the heavy torso end.
The body,
said Lucy, still staring at the corpse.
I felt the legs move.
Move? Said Dan, dropping the torso and stepping back.
Not move, but slip. I... Look,
she said, carefully sliding the dead man's trouser leg upward.
What the...
said Dan, crouching for a closer look. The leg had disintegrated into a hideous, sloppy form.
How long's this one been here? What is that, gangrene?
Asked Dan. I'm not sure, said Lucy, pulling the trouser further up. It's some kind of infection.
Ugh, tapeworms! Boy, this one has turned. Let's get it in the truck before I barf,
said Lucy, bending down and clasping the hems of each trouser leg. On 3? Said Dan, putting his hands under the armpits again.
1, 2, 3.
Lucy and Dan both stood up, lifting the corpse off the ground. It sagged heavily in the center.
Ready to swing?
She checked as they shuffled closer to the back of the garbage truck.
Yup,
replied Dan, leading the swinging motions.
1, 2. Ah, shit,
he cried as the body tore in the middle, sending both him and Lucy off balance. Lucy yelped in disgust, dropping the severed legs she now held and looking in horror at the writhing mass of rotting guts that lay on the road before them.
This is too much,
yelled Dan, hurtling the top half of the body into the garbage truck, sending flecks of rotten flesh through the air. Lucy looked at the human entrails that had spilled out from the dead man's midriff and choked back the vomit. The entrails writhed with the activity of the worms feasting among them.
This is too damned much, said Dan again as he grabbed a shovel from the back of the truck and scooped up the festering remains, slinging them into the back. Luce,
he said impatiently, storming over and negotiating the legs onto the shovel in a vile balancing act. She ignored him, returning to where they'd found the body and staring at the lone squirming tapeworm left on the tar. She stepped on it hard, twisting her foot from side to side, feeling the worm turn to pulp beneath her.
You done?
Called Dan, walking back to the front of the truck. Lifting her foot back off, she looked at the yellow-brown mess that was left.
Yeah,
replied Lucy. I'm done.
Wait,
came a muffled voice from behind. Lucy spun around, startled. Miles was quickly limping towards her from the other side of the street.
Oh, shit, cursed Lucy, turning and hurrying back towards the truck. Lucy, I know that's you, Miles shouted through his mask. Those suits are my property. Get back here.
She reached up, pulling open the passenger door.
Lucy, give me my fucking suits, yelled Miles again, closing in.
Lucy scrambled up the steps into the cab and threw herself into the passenger seat.
Drive, Marco, she yelled.
Say what?
He asked, nodding his head to the blaring heavy metal. She leaned to pull the door closed, but Miles' hand wrapped around her forearm, dragging her from the vehicle.
Dan!
She cried, falling hard on the asphalt.
Lucy, I don't want to have to do this, implored Miles. You know that. Just give me the goddamn suit. Please. I'm begging you. It's mine. You know it is.
Lucy squinted up at him, silhouetted against the bright blue sky. He was crying. That's when she saw the knife.
I don't want to do this. You know that, right?
He pointed at her with the blade.
We go back a long way. Just give me the damn suit,
he yelled, lunging towards her. Out of nowhere, a shovel drove into the side of Miles' head with a clang, sending him plummeting to the ground. Before she could say anything, Dan lifted the shovel again and smashed it down onto Miles' skull. He struck again and again until Miles' brains were splattered across the street. Lucy sat sprawled on the ground, shaking, flecks of blood covering her suit. The rock music blaring from the truck stopped. Dan stood up and dropped the shovel, staggering backwards.
He was gonna stab you. I had no choice, stammered Dan. He was gonna stab you!
His hands were trembling and his shoulders heaving as he swayed on the spot, traumatized.
I know, quavered Lucy,
climbing to her trembling legs.
I know he was.
She took Dan's visor in her hands.
It's okay. Shh. It's okay now.
We need to get rid of his body,
panted Dan, looking wildly around the deserted street.
Okay,
said Lucy.
We can do that. Just be calm now. It's over.
As she returned and looked at the body again, dizziness swept through her. Dan wailed in anguish.
I'll take the... You take the legs,
said Lucy, placing a hand under each of Miles' armpits, more blood spilling onto her suit.
Dan? Dan!
She shouted. He was beginning to go into shock. She dropped Miles' body and stepped up to her partner, shaking him hard.
Hey, look at me. Look at me! You're okay, right? You're okay.
She resumed her position.
Take his legs,
she ordered, fighting to keep her voice flat. One, two, three. They staggered backwards with the decapitated body, its heat radiating through their gloves.
Again, on three,
said Lucy as they lined up level with the back of the truck. Miles' body landed in the refuse area, but rolled back towards them, his arm flopping over the metal lip.
Jesus Christ,
winced Lucy, gagging as she flipped his hand back into the dumpster. She grabbed the control box and hit compress. Miles' body vanished into the churning folds of humans. The squelching and cracking of flesh and bone projected over the mechanical groans of the dumpster. Dan stared, transfixed. Lucy led him back to the cab of the truck, where she helped him up the steps.
Buckle yourself in,
she said, lifting his trembling hand onto the seatbelt, before hopping out again and retrieving the shovel. She clipped the bloodied implement back into place on the rear of the truck and rejoined her partner, who was shaking too much to push the seat buckles together.
I've got it,
she said, leaning over and finishing it for him.
What the hell just happened?
Said Marco.
Someone tried to kill me, replied Lucy. Please take us back to the depot, Marco.
Gotcha,
he said, hitting play on the CD deck and pulling away, singing loudly and cheerfully as Lucy's eyes glazed over.
That's 3 hours,
said Dan, lifting his head from the mattress in 403 and checking the clock on the wall.
Thank God,
heaved Lucy, tearing off her hazmat suit and taking a deep breath of unfiltered air. The sweat on her skin chilled, sending refreshing shivers across her body. That 403's gerbil was still alive had been the only mercy of the day. Lucy couldn't yet vouch for the one they'd left in Manuela's place, but there was an outside chance they'd be able to use her toilet safely if it was still alive, too. Dan slammed his palms against the wall, leaning into it, his head dipped, the half-unzipped hazmat suit still hung around his waist. "You okay?" questioned Lucy, pausing her wet wipe shower. "Sorry, that was a stupid thing to ask. Of course you're not."
"I'm fine," snapped Dan, not turning around.
"What happened to Miles?"
"That wasn't your—"
"I know," he interrupted, grabbing the box of wipes.
"Good. Right," said Lucy. "I mean, I know how horrible that was for you. I'm just trying to say thank you for saving me."
Dan paused, his cheeks pressed upward by the cleansing towels in his hands.
"I've never killed anyone before. You know that?"
he said, dropping his hands to his sides and staring somewhere beyond the wall.
5 years of service. Never had to do it. Always counted myself lucky."
He turned to face her at last.
"Are we kidding ourselves? All these bullshit systems we've put into place, waiting 3 hours, living in plastic suits, relying on dead people's pets to keep us alive, when all it takes is one psycho with a knife, a friend for Christ's sake, and that's it, game over."
"Don't talk like that," urged Lucy. "Your systems have kept us alive." She picked up the wipes, offering him a fresh one.
"We can make it through this. We've got each other, and we're going to make it through. You hear me?"
Dan snatched the pack from her and held it by his side.
"We both know we're living on luck as much as anything," said Lucy, resuming her cleaning. "But if we stay careful, if we keep our systems, maybe we'll make enough luck to see this thing through."
"Yeah," grunted Dan, nodding and shifting his weight.
"Right."
He nodded more vigorously, his face screwing up with anger until he hurled the pack of cleaning wipes to the floor.
"And what exactly is this thing, Lucy?"
he snarled.
"What exactly is that oily crap that washed up on the beach? All those spores that turned literally the entire city yellow, then killed everyone. Hey, what is that, huh?"
He thumped his fist against the dressing table as he began to pace, jolting the antiquated jewelry, makeup, and redundant lamps from their resting places.
"And how about that weird-ass stuff that's growing everywhere, huh?"
he gestured wildly with his arms as he paced.
"How about the plants sprouting up in all the streets? Do they look normal to you, Lucy? Do they look normal?"
Lucy continued her changeover, trying not to cry in front of him.
"We both act like we've not seen them," he fumed, "because it's just one more bullshit thing to deal with. But the truth is, we're both stuck here guessing and being lucky while everyone else dies. And we don't mention the fact that there are brambles growing out of our drains, or mold covering the bus stop, or the fact that everything looks wet now. What is that, Lucy, huh?"
He slapped both hands out against the wall again and leaned in, exhaling heavily with his eyes closed, muttering incoherently. Lucy calmed herself, pulling her hazmat suit back on over her legs and arms so that just her head was exposed. Dan's heaving breaths began to subside. Lucy moved next to him, hovering under one of his outstretched arms.
"You finished?"
she said, forcing him to look her in the eye.
"Yeah, finished,"
he replied, blushing and flitting his eyes back to the ground.
"Good. I'll make us some dinner. Get clean and suit up. We need to eat quickly and then get our masks back on."